Yadā yadā hi dharmasya glānir bhavati bhārata abhyutthānam adharmasya tadātmānam śrijāmyaham paritrānāya sādhanam vināśāya ca duṣkṛtam dharmasthāpanārthāya sambhavāmi yuge yuge. When evil grows weak, when goodness grows weak and evil increases, I embody myself, I come forth and am born on earth for the establishment of righteousness and the putting down of evil. I manage to make myself human from age to age. Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhetamastu Ma Vindushavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being
look over us lovingly as a mother and father.
May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om peace, 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 peace be unto us all. Welcome to our Christmas Sunday. I thought we've so often dwelt upon the life and teachings of Jesus in past years as Vedantists understand it and comparing it with Christian understandings. I thought we'd look today, this year, at how Jesus is regarded in other great faiths of the world. I'm going to start with those which are in the same family, Judaism, and then Islam, and then move out to Buddhism and Vedanta. In Judaism, for centuries, there was just almost silence about Jesus. And that's understandable, isn't it? When you think about the bad feeling that has existed, that existed for so long in the world between the political and military forces of Christianity and Judaism, and the amount of persecution and the amount of disdain and disregard that Christians have had for Jews historically. It's not very surprising that the Jews wouldn't for a long time want to talk about this prophet, this renegade. But now that the world has come in touch with it, with itself, the parts of the world are coming into contact, we have quite a lot of Jewish views about Jesus. Many different views are there. Some of them, the minority I should say, overlook his Jewish origin and treat him as if they were talking about Confucius or Buddha. That is to say, is another world prophet, leader of a denomination, leader of a world religion, and we shall look upon him as something alien, outside our borders, like somebody from another part of the world. And of course the majority don't look upon it that way. They see Jesus as someone of their own. One of our boys made it the old joke, you know. And they have various things to say about it. And one of the things that they say is that there are many tales. There are tales about the birth of Moses and about the birth of Abraham which match the tales of Jesus' birth. Now, I didn't know that before a few days ago, that there are such stories of miraculous type of birth and advent surrounding Moses and surrounding Abraham. I don't know whether they're in the Torah or not, or they probably are not. They're probably apocryphal to the Torah. But anyway, those exist. When you come to the point of the Messiah, here's a very interesting thing. Well, Christians have all these years, you know, the Orthodox Christian view is that Jesus was the Messiah who was predicted, who was expected from the Jewish writings and from the prophets and the priests of the Jewish faith. And of course the Jews have constantly just as vehemently denied that any of those passages in the Old Testament refer to anybody who has yet come. They still see that the Messiah is yet to come. And their picture of the Messiah too is quite different from that of the Christian. After all, their picture of the Messiah was that of a political figure, a political power, someone who would rescue them from the tyranny of the Romans. That was their great hope. The Messiah would be what the Jews always want people to be, want their leaders to be, leaders of the tribe, leaders of the people. They don't want personal, individual salvation in that sense. They don't want a new world, a new heaven and a new earth. They want to be delivered from the hands of their oppressors. And so their idea of the Messiah is quite different from that of the Christians, and the Christians do not usually take it into account. One interesting a remark made by the Jewish writer was that, after all, the scripture predicts that the Messiah would come to relieve the misery of the Jews, and all that the Messiah of the Christians has done has been to increase the misery of the Jews down through the ages, which you have to admit. You have to admit it. The majority of Jews regard Jesus as one of the Pharisees. Now, you see, in the Bible, in the New Testament, the Pharisees are bad-mouthed not only by Jesus Christ, but by all of the other people around him. I mean, the writers, the gospel makers, and so on. And the rest of the writers, St. Paul, the Jews are, the Pharisees are attacked. And what we learn from a study of the Jewish tradition itself, from the old accounts of that time, and by the Jewish historians, is that the Pharisees were worthy people. Commendable, leading holy lives. Aside from being priestly, they had the respect of the people. They had the honor due to a Brahminical type of caste. And there were many Pharisees who were preaching at that time, preaching different things. And so the Jews, the majority view of the Jews is that Jesus was one of those Pharisees, one of the prophetically minded, honorable people of the community who happened to go off on a tangent. See? That's they will say, oh yes, like Rabbi Hillel and the other rabbis of that time, Jesus was a rabbi, no doubt. But what happened was that he preached views which were eccentric and not traditional, and there were people who followed all of these different Pharisees, and what happened was there was an internal Jewish argument. He was at odds with the Pharisees that we read about in the New Testament, and so he had an internal Jewish argument with them. And because the group that followed him wanted to distinguish itself very early from others, they took him up, made him the champion of a sect which wanted separate identity. So they look upon the early Christian church as people who had such a yearning and a need for a separate identity, an agenda of their own, that they took up this Pharisee's teachings and glorified him, and the church made him into the Christ and so on, all the divinity that got around it. Well, it was at that time, of course, that, as I say, there was the expectation of a political party, and there was a lot of politics involved in the interaction between the different Jewish groups and sects. And if you read that history, you'll see how Christianity developed as one who had to make enemies of its rivals in order to establish its identity, in order to be supreme over those who were rivaling it. It had to establish itself on very solid grounds and make itself unusual. Well, some Jewish views are like that of Albert Schweitzer. Do you know? I wonder how many of you know. Albert Schweitzer wrote a book, In Quest of the Historical Jesus. And Schweitzer, a Christian, a missionary to Africa, a doctor, an organist, a great man. Albert Schweitzer wrote this book, In Search of the Historical Jesus. And his conclusions, he didn't have the scholarship that we have today. He didn't have the Essenes, the Dead Sea Scrolls. He didn't have those things. It was written quite a long time ago in our 19th century, but 20th century. But his conclusion in that book is, Jesus expected the imminent destruction of the earth, of the world. He expected this whole cosmos to explode and disappear very soon. So they take his, what do you call eschatology? Is that the word? Eschatological teachings. They take his eschatological pronouncements as meaning that this is going to happen within our life, within the lifetime of these people that we're talking to. He was talking to. So Schweitzer makes Jesus out to be a somewhat deluded, wonderful man, but somewhat deluded into thinking that there was going to be a cataclysm and end of the world, and that all the people that would hear his voice would be saved from that, somehow spared. And this is a view which many Jews have taken up. They have, or maybe they invented it, I don't know. But anyway, they agree with Schweitzer. And you know, the interesting thing is that Jesus' calls for renunciation, you know what that means in our tradition, his demands for leaving the family, turning against the world, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar, give to God the things that are God's, his turning his back on society in a certain sense and preaching what we would call monastic ideals and renunciation. All of that, this view says, he did all of that because he was expecting this cataclysmic end of the world. So what would these things be worth? He could give them up, they're not worth anything. Throw them away. That, you see how that undercuts the spiritual meaning of renunciation. So it doesn't mean that you yourself have to renounce these things in order to realize the Heavenly Father or have union with God. I mean, those things that Christian mystics believe, that doesn't come into the picture for the Jews, because they can accuse him of having delusions of grandeur and destruction. The Jewish view of Jesus' visions, the vision Jesus' visions in the garden and in other places where he had visions, and then the visions which the gospel makers or the followers of Christ had of him afterwards, Paul on the road to Damascus, and the other visions that were involved with the resurrection, the crucifixion, and the resurrection in the garden and all that. The Jewish view is these were dreams and daydreams. And finally, I think I should mention the views of Harold Kushner, who wrote that book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and other books since then. Kushner blames original sin idea on St. Paul. He says he doesn't find in Jesus' teaching the idea of original sin. You have to go to Paul for that. And so I take it from that he has more approval of Jesus than of Paul. And he opines that these people, Jesus and Paul, the leaders of Christianity, the founders of Christianity. Now, this is very interesting. The founders of Christianity were used by God to teach Yahweh to the world. They were used by God as instruments to spread the name of Yahweh, Jehovah, to the world through the Christian medium. I never heard that before, but that's Harold Kushner's view. So for him, Yahweh is everything. The Hebrew God, the Jewish God, is everything. And the whole history of Christianity has this wonderful aspect about it, whatever it may have done to the Jews, that it popularizes the name of Jehovah. Well, let's go to Islam. And then, by the way, you know, this informal class, if anybody has anything to add or to subtract or to comment on, you please interrupt me.
Christians who believe in Trinity.
Pardon?
Christians who, yes, believe in Trinity,
yes,
which I guess most of them do,
yeah,
say that Jesus is God.
Yeah.
Jesus, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, yeah, are all one.
Yeah.
Sort of like Advaita,
yeah,
principle, it looks like. So they don't even consider Jehovah as separate from Jesus. So,
that's right.
So this Kushner's idea of Jesus was put here by God.
Yeah, he has to ignore Jesus. He has to ignore the Christian claims of Trinity and all that.
But then the Jehovah's Witnesses, though.
Well, that's a separate thing.
I just learned about that about a month ago. I was very surprised that they have a separate Bible where when they talk about the Word, they don't say that the Word, they say a Word, apparently, or something in their version of the Bible. So they make Jehovah and Jesus separate.
Oh, they do.
I didn't know that. Son of God and not a Son of God, apparently, and not the God himself.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that also for a long time.
But also, I mean, Christ says the Father is greater than I am.
Right. But yeah. He also says I and the Father are one.
That's true.
So.
Well, if you're willing, we'll go to Islam. Islam is the daughter of both Judaism and Christianity. It's the later arrival. And it refers to its antecedents and itself as the people of the book. Now, what is the book? The book means, in their view, all in the Torah, Talmud, that they accept, and all in the Old and New Testaments that they accept, plus the Quran. Well, no, not the Quran. The Quran is out. That's the book that those are the people of. We are the people of the book. We have the tradition in back of us of the Jewish writings and the Christian writings, the story of the Jews, their saga, and the story of Jesus Christ. Here, too, in Islam, there are many subdivisions in understanding, in having views, opinions, and there is a common view. Broadly speaking, I can divide them into the Orthodox Muslims and the Black Muslims. I'll come to the Black Muslims later. I want to talk about the Orthodox Islam. You know, that's a mistaken notion that we have. I think the general picture that Christians have of Islam is that it's monolithic, that it has a kind of solitary structures, undivided agreement, sort of a unity that it doesn't really have. There are the Ahmadiyya Muslims, and there are the Sufis, and other branches that we don't even know of out there in the Far East, Near East. And so it's not really correct conception to think of Islam as having one voice. It has many voices as well. And as I say, broadly divided into Orthodox and including the Sufis, as far as Jesus is concerned, and the Black Muslims. Well, Orthodox Islam denies that Jesus suffered martyrdom. He didn't die. If he was put on the cross, he lived through it. That's their story. He did not die on the cross. And they regard him as one of their very own prophets. They recite his teachings. They tell his stories and parables. They refer to him and his mother constantly throughout their religious practices. And it is surprising to me that the Christians that I have known most of my life have been ignorant of the fact that Jesus was as revered as he was among the Muslims, is as revered as he is among the Muslims. He's considered one of their prophets, one of the major prophets. Abraham, Moses, Ishmael, and on down through the major prophets of the Old Testament, and to Jesus, and then on to Muhammad. He taught, he led, he worked miracles. All this is acknowledged. But not that he was killed by anyone. The Quran says the following things. Jesus preached in his cradle. Didn't know that, did you? When the wise men came and the angels on Christmas Eve, the babe preached to them good things. Doesn't say what he preached, but he preached. Why? Because it was predicted in the Muslim tradition, it was predicted that Jesus would preach as a babe. So that is, it fulfilled the prophecy, you see. The Quran denies that he ever told people that he was divine. It denies that he ever told people to worship him as a divine figure. So I guess when you make a new religion, you can take what you want from the previous ones and mold it to your own shape, your own preferences. But that's what they do. They say that he did not teach. He was just a prophet in the line of prophets. He never pretended or proclaimed to be anything but a prophet of the book. And that he was not killed by the Jews, and he was not claiming himself to be anything more than the prophets that went before him. And yet, you see, in Islam, Mary is more than she is in Christianity. The mother of Jesus has stories told about her in Islam. She is revered as much as Jesus himself, which I think is quite remarkable. And Mary has a history, she's given a history of which we do not know in Christianity. And there are stories about Jesus too, I'll come to in a minute, but Mary is regarded as probably the most important woman, apart from Khadija, in the Islamic tradition. I think that's something that most Christians do not know. One of the stories told about Jesus is that story which you find in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, where the teacher, the pupil, the student asks the teacher, "How can I realize God? How can I know God?" And the teacher takes hold of the student and leads him to the river and puts him under water and holds him there. And when he comes up gasping for breath, the teacher asks the disciple, "How did you feel under water when I held you?" And he said, "Oh, I felt I would be gasping for air. I felt I would give anything to have air." And he said, "Well, when you feel that way about God, you'll get him." This is a Muslim story. I don't know whether Sri Ramakrishna knew that it was a Muslim story, but it is. It's a story from Islam which has come into the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. They tell that about Jesus. Interestingly, the Quran says that Jesus was the Messiah of the Jews. So there's another thorn, a bone to pick between Islam and Judaism. Islam says, yes, Jesus was the Messiah you were looking for. You didn't recognize him. You didn't know that that was the Messiah. And so they rejected him. The Jews had rejected him, and it's too bad, but we Muslims don't look for a Messiah. The Messiah idea didn't seem to be necessary in Islam. There was no demand for it, no need for it, no prediction of it, no prophecy about it, that there should be a Messiah of any kind. They do know that Jesus said, I will send you a comforter. You know he did. I've forgotten which gospel it is. Maybe two of them. He says, I leave you, but there's a comforter will come. And that's the all that's said about it. It's not explained who it would be. But Muhammad said that he was the comforter that was to come, and that's what Muslims believe, that Muhammad was the expected successor or follower after Christ. In the Orthodox Islam, there is no Trinity, as you were saying. Similarly for Islam, there's no Trinity. God is one, alone, has no partners, no offspring. No Trinity. So there cannot be a Son of God. In fact, the Quran ridicules the idea that God could have a son. What? God having a son? Unimaginable. So, Allah. Allahu Akbar. Allah is the great. And the only one. And no Trinity, no partners, no offspring. A special case has to be made for the black Muslims, especially since we're in Atlanta and there are many of them here. You need to talk about it. You know, it was a movement born pretty much in Chicago. I was in Chicago for a number of years, and I had to drive past the masjid, the temple, I think they called it, frequently. And I would see the titles of Elijah Muhammad's sermons. Elijah Muhammad was an impressive person. And the line of succession in black Islam is Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, and Dean Muhammad. There couldn't be three more different people. Totally different people. So I have to talk a little bit about each of them. Elijah Muhammad, who founded the black Muslim movement, fabricated tales about Jesus. Unashamedly, unabashedly, made up stories and told them to his congregation. No, nobody ever heard of before. It was purely his own invention. And the audience seemed to enjoy them, so he perpetuated them. And Elijah hinted that it wasn't Muhammad, but it was Elijah that was the comforter that was to come. I don't think he said it in so many words, but he hinted that the comforter promised by Jesus was Elijah Muhammad. One of the things he said very many times is, understand, this is a congregation of largely American, African Americans who had been drawn by his charisma, his power, his preaching, to make up a congregation. There were very few non-Africans in there. And he said, Jesus is dead. He cannot help us. I wonder what that, what shock or effect that had upon the congregation. But he insisted that there was not to be, there was no help to be had from Jesus. He couldn't be our Savior. He couldn't be anything. Anything to us today, because he is long dead. Well, you come to Malcolm X, and you have a very totally different situation. You probably know him as well as I do, or more better, much better, because I wasn't in circulation at the time of Malcolm. But he played up all the angry parts of Jesus' life, where Jesus cursed the fig tree, and where Jesus took the scourge to the temple, drove out the money changers. Those are the parts that made Jesus a hero to Malcolm. He hated the idea that Jesus would be called weak, mild, and weak, meek and subservient. He said that may be the picture of him in the Gospels, but that's not the picture in the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation, he comes riding a horse, white horse, with a sword, a shining sword, double-edged sword coming out of his mouth, and he comes to chastise the nations. And this is the Jesus that Malcolm worships. So he made a great deal. They played up that part of his story and said that when he came with a sword, that was when he was showing his true mission in life, his true purpose of being born. The quotation from Book of Revelation is like this: "From his mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations, and he will rule them with the rod of iron. He will be called the King of Kings." And when we have these anthems and celebrate the King of Kings and all that sort, much of that language is taken from the Book of Revelation that refers to Jesus. So he has some, this God has some scriptural basis for saying what he says. But the most surprising thing that Malcolm said was, Jesus was not really a white man at all. He was black. And he was sent to the Jewish devils, calling the Jewish people, the people that were the Pharisees, Sadducees, and so on, calling them the devils of Judaism. He says that Jesus was sent to them, and he was a Negro. His suffering and death, according to Malcolm, are only a symbol of black history. His suffering and death symbolize the whole history of the black race. Well, that is Islam. Anybody have questions or comments? Yes.
I feel there's been some
a little louder
information that I've gotten over the years about the aspect of Malcolm X's life after he had a chance to take a pilgrimage to Mecca. That changes his message. I'm not quite.
How did he change it?
Well, from the way I understand it, his view became less about Islam being strictly for the black man.
Oh.
And it was.
He realized there were lots of other Muslims.
He realized the context of yeah. Islam in the world.
Okay.
That's
good.
It softened. His message definitely softened and broadened after that.
I didn't realize that. I'm glad you put that in.
In fact, that's a lot of the theory of why he was eventually murdered. was because his
softened the message
much more expansive.
Just like Gandhi.
Yes.
I have one more remark because I met Dean Muhammad two years ago. I met Dean Muhammad at Atlanta University and Morehouse College, and we spoke on the same platform. He was the most gracious person. He was so meek and so, we'd say, sattvic. He's a gem of a man. He's a beautiful character. And he treated me like I was his equal. And he gave the most excellent speech. I don't know what has happened to the movement, but if it's under Dean Muhammad, the son of Elijah, it ought to be respected by everyone. Let's come to Buddhism. Oh, I'm sorry.
Swami, I had a couple of questions about traditional Islam. Do the traditional Islam scholars recognize and study the Dead Sea Scrolls or the writings of the Essenes? Because wouldn't that in some way change their thinking or message?
You know, Jillian, I don't know about that. I would imagine that the more liberal or open-minded ones do, because they'd have to. In fact, the Jesus Seminar, which was that group of people that studied the five Gospels and put out the book, The Five Gospels. Those people who did that seminar, were in that seminar, I think one or two of them were Muslims. Some were Jews, some were nothing, no atheists, some were Christians, and I think there was one or two Muslims.
But you're saying probably the more liberal side of
they must have been, yeah. You know, there's Nasser. Do you know the name of Nasser? Well, he's a very modern, liberal Muslim scholar. What's his first name? I can't think of his first name. But he is, he would certainly take all those things into account, I know. Yes?
The gospel I've read gives no clue as to what Jesus looked like. Do you?
I didn't hear you.
The gospels I've read give no clue as to what Jesus looked like.
No.
Have any of the Pharisees or anyone wrote what he looked like?
No. There's a description from the 11th century which has been shown to be fake. What do you say? What's the proper word?
Interpolation.
Yeah, well, no, it's just cooked up.
Fabrication.
They try to sneak it in as a discovery, like those relics that you find in places. You know.
Well, presumably he was neither white nor black. He was Middle Eastern.
Well, surly, of course.
So, you know, that's where he was born.
Yeah. All the pictures.
Well, Western world thinks it's middle white. Yeah.
Yes, you read the book, didn't you? Yes.
Sri Ramakrishna had a vision of Jesus.
Yes.
And he says that he looked like a foreign according to him. So obviously he has to be more fair complexion than Indian.
Yeah, well.
Following up on his, people who doubt the historical character that Jesus was, always points to the fact that with all these gospels,
that's right.
There is just absolutely no personal description of a person.
I know.
Which is remarkable, if you really think about that.
But when you take that view that Jesus possibly didn't live at all, I mean, Swami Vivekananda entertained that view at one time,
right.
that maybe Jesus was never born. It was all fabricated story. But then you can't, if you say that, then how do you account for the Muslim?
The Muslim movement, though, could have borrowed all the information.
No. If you understand the Muslim tradition, they don't go and do that sort of thing. It's ingrained. It comes from the family. It's culturally runs through the whole line of people back through the tribe.
One other point I'd like to make about that: the current scholarship, as I understand it, is that in the first century after Jesus' death, there were three primary factions of Judaism, the mm-hmm. three main ones, mm-hmm. and Christianity was the largest.
Yes.
It was considered a faction of Judaism That's for right. at least the first 100 or 200 years of its existence, and it wasn't until it became basically a Gentile movement that it became an aversion to the dominant Jewish population because they began to feel overwhelmed by all the Gentiles who
threatened.
And so Judaism retreated back into its more mm-hmm. traditional teachings.
Well, I thought I hinted at that, but that's...
You've extrapolated.
It's good. Yeah, that's right.
The other thing I have heard, Swami, is that Jesus could have been a composite of several prophets.
Yes, that's...
And that maybe why there's no description is because if you're talking about the lives of two or three different people, then there is no physical individual.
No, but you also have to realize the mentality of people of those days. I'm sure they were not historically minded any more than the Hindus. And I don't think that they would be, you know, anxious to leave a record of what somebody looked like. You see what I'm saying?
So do you think there's no validity to the fact that it could have been two or three different people?
Oh, yeah, no, I don't deny that.
Okay.
But I'm saying an alternative explanation might be that they just simply didn't have any historical interest in historical records, or they may have been lost. Let's go on to Buddhism before we can get through here. Oh.
I just wanted to say that, you know, a lot of the Nag Hammadi library that was 2 years before Qumran would support exactly what you're saying and exactly what Catherine was saying, that there was a lot of diversity pre Nicaea, and that you know, if there a lot of what we have in canon now came out of that controversy, and that the early Christians, like later Christians, tend to read back through the Gospel of John, the Trinitarian part, into Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and that. There was a lot of controversy.
There was a lot of stuff that...
And the apocalypse by many were considered to be heresy, but somehow with Irenaeus' help they got into the...
Camp. Oh, the Christian church made a lot of mischief.
Yeah.
Swami? Sorry. But if I'm just going to mention the Shroud of Turin. If there's any validity in that, then that could be...
Yeah, I'm most scientists are very skeptical of the Shroud of Turin.
They either say Leonardo da Vinci may
have done it. Well, it's still highly controversial. Mm-hmm. If you like to believe in it, that's good, because I don't want to take a position on it. That's good, you mentioned it, though. Well, in Buddhism. Of course, the Buddhists learned of Jesus from the missionaries. The Buddhist countries, I'm not including here the apocryphal story of Jesus' travel to Tibet. Let's not bring that up, because first of all, I don't believe it. And then I don't want to argue about it. But let's have the missionaries going to the Buddhist countries and preaching their gospel. Now, you know, Buddhism is divided into three broad categories, well, more than that, but we say Mahayana, Theravada, and Zen, as far as we know now, we're familiar with now. The Theravadins are not people who look around very much. Theravada Buddhists don't usually pay much attention to other faiths. And I didn't find in Theravadin literature any particular mention of Jesus. So the opinions that come out from the Buddhists are generally from the Mahayana Buddhists. And also, you know, Zen isn't much given to articulating theories and things like that. It's concerned with practice. So we go to the Mahayanists primarily for the things which we hear about Jesus. They admit that he was a fine, a wonderful human being, and they admire him as an individual, but not his claims. As you know, Buddha himself did not claim a divine origin or a divine inspiration. He talked about making your own, being a lamp unto yourself. So they don't accept the claims that Jesus made for himself. They call him very often a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva is, of course, a person who, on the verge of attaining his own enlightenment, steps back and accepts the bondage of teaching mankind, enlightening others, and bringing them into nirvana before he, into enlightenment, before he goes into it himself. So they regard Jesus as that kind of a person, a bodhisattva. And as a magician, interestingly, the miracles are explained as magic, that he was a superb magician, and he was the manifestation of a deity. This is the Mahayana view. He was the manifestation of a deity. Now, deities for them are not like the Christian God. They are not even like the Hindu gods. Deities are a dime a dozen. You can have deities all over the place. The Buddhist deities are seized upon, are embodied in human beings of various kinds, lamas, and great souls can become considered embodiments of a deity. But of course he's not the only one. He was a manifestation of a deity. And when they regard him as that, they don't regard him as the only one. And no deity in the pantheon of the Buddhist deities is a creator of the universe. No deity can create the universe, and no deity can offer salvation to all. These are very important distinctions for the Buddhists. No God creates the universe, and no God can offer universal salvation by any means. So Jesus is a way. The Christians are following a way, not the way. Buddhist view is that crucifixion was Jesus' atonement for his own personal sin. Are you like that?
So and if you, bad karma?
Yes. And if you ask, what sins did Jesus perpetrate? The example is given of Herod's killing all the little boys. It was on Jesus' account that Herod killed all the little boys. And other things that Jesus is responsible for, the coming of Jesus responsible for, that they are the sins for which he, like us, had to atone. And so he suffered on the cross, he suffered on the cross, just as we suffer for our own bad karma. Most of the Buddhists reject the idea of vicarious atonement. I think the Pure Land sect, way over in China, eastern part of China, has a little of that doctrine in it, but by and large, Buddhists reject the idea of vicarious atonement, that somebody can die for another person's sins.
As I understand, for many
divine figures in Hinduism. The fact that they're a manifestation of God doesn't mean that they don't sin or create bad karma. It means that they atone for it all before they leave the world.
Okay, but when we come to the end of my talk, we'll hear about avatar as a different category. So,
what did the scholars say? Do you not want another question?
I can wait if you can wait.
I can wait.
All right. No, I mean, I can wait if they can wait.
Okay.
Go on.
What did the scholars say about the fact that many instances in Jesus' life, the stories about Jesus' life are so parallel with Buddha, such as the 40 days in the desert and
Bodhi
tree and the armies who came to test him. I mean, they're so.
Also, the 500 disciples.
Oh,
yeah.
They admire. Oh, they admire that. They don't think it's borrowed, though. I mean, they admire that.
But you know, Swami testing
me. Yeah, the Buddhists admire all that. They think Jesus lived a very good life. No, I was surprised in reading about Buddhist views how much of Jesus they really do accept. It's just they don't. That divinity business. That's.
That's not it.
Now, let me finish with Buddhism, and then we can ask some more questions. They say, this is most interesting to me, they say that his chief teaching, the chief teaching of Buddha, was how to go beyond the ego boundary. Chief teaching of Jesus was how to go beyond the ego boundary, limitation of the ego. So that there is just the opposite of what the Jews do. It spiritualizes his message to the utmost, we should say. Yeah?
I guess the question for me is, do the Buddhists believe that Jesus was an enlightened being?
Yes, they do. Yes, bodhisattva means enlightened. You just don't accept nirvana.
So he is on par with the Buddha.
Well, not for them. He wouldn't be on a par with the Buddha. No.
If he was an enlightened being, he would be on
par. No, enlightened beings aren't all on the same level.
And then Buddhists are taught not to worship Buddha. I
mean,
taught. You know, you too can be enlightened like Buddha, and to worship him and put him on his pedestal beyond you is not. Authentic Buddhism. So it's a very different approach to kind of the leader of the.
Jesus' love and tolerance toward the weak and the sinful, Mary Magdalene and so on, and the tax collectors, his love and tolerance toward the weak and the sinful come not from his divinity, but from his humanity. His resurrection was a myth, and the cursing of the fig tree and the driving of the money changers out of the temple are to be deplored as acts of violence. That takes away from his glamour, because he did those things. He's not equal to the Buddha because of those things also. And this very interesting thing, that evil to the Christians and the Jews, of course, it applies to us all, for us also in Vedanta. Evil to the Christians and the Jews is external. In Buddhism, it is not. Think about that. Just think about that and the implications of it. For Jews and Christians, a large part of the religious world, evil is something outside. The Buddhists and Vedantists, it is not.
I don't understand that, Swami. Could you explain that a little?
In a few minutes. I want to finish the Buddhist account with a special case of Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh is, as you know, a very popular and very sattvic Buddhist teacher of our time, who has an ashram in France, and who I've heard him speak in the Department of Religions, and whom I admire very much. And he has written a book called Jesus, about Jesus and Buddha being brothers. And in that book, he uses the teachings of the words of Jesus and the words of Buddha interchangeably. He goes right from one to the other. You wouldn't know that there, I mean, he was making any distinction between them. He uses that. Just goes right from one to the other. blends them together. And he's interested in the Holy Spirit. He's interested in the Trinity. He doesn't deny that Trinity idea that the Christians have. And he's very accommodating to Christian ideas, and of course he teaches Christian people, so he has to have that kind of acceptance of their mentality. But he says that the Holy Spirit means the positive energy in the world. What's meant by the Holy Spirit is the positive energy in the world. I suppose in Vedanta we'd say the positive side of Shakti. He calls Jesus one of his spiritual ancestors. And he does a lot of accommodating to the Christian congregations that he, or people that he speaks to, Jewish and Christian people. So I would have to make a particular case out of this Buddhist. And finally, we come to Vedanta. That's Jesus in another religion. And you know our views. I think you know them pretty well. I'm just going to lightly brush on them. We believe in the doctrine, as my invocation indicated, that God can come to earth and take form, human form. And that he has done so on a number of occasions. And our leader, Swami Vivekananda, teaches that God comes and embodies himself on earth about every 500 or 800 or 1,000 years, something like that. Big gaps like that. And Sri Ramakrishna, of course, accepted, in his spiritual understanding, accepted Ramachandra, and Sri Krishna, and Buddha, and Christ as avatars. So that we try to follow pretty much that in that mold. We're celebrating Christmas Eve. Is it Friday? Friday night, we're celebrating his birth, as God born as a babe. And celebrate it as such. Because we believe that there is something more than just enlightened souls in the world. There are individuals who are the founders of world faiths. Now, from that standpoint, you'd almost have to say, well, Muhammad was the founder of a world faith. But there are other criteria besides that. Certainly, the Jews, by not recognizing that there is a tremendous power behind someone who founds a world faith, it seems to me, are particularly dense. I can't understand why that Jewish outlook would not acknowledge the divine, the divinity of the power behind a faith like Christianity or Buddhism or Islam. We believe that that's how those faiths get born. They get born with the advent of a God figure. And another interesting thing about Vedanta and Christianity, so what it really shows, if I were to talk for another 15 minutes, and I'm not going to, I could show you how much Christianity and Vedanta have in common. There's quite a lot, but I will only mention, and that makes them closer, two faiths closer than perhaps any of the other two faiths that we've discussed this morning. One of them is the God baby. No other faith in the world has the same emphasis on the child. God as a child. Ramlala, Gopala, Jesus, baby Jesus. The sanctity or the purity or the holiness of an innocence of the child and the godliness of a child, and God being born as a child and much being made of it, and having the idea of God as a child as your chosen form of worship. All of those things are possible in Christianity and in Vedanta. Time has run out, and I want you to have time for questions, discussion. So I draw my line there, which could have been extended considerably. Please.
I was speaking to a guest that we had once.
Who?
A guest that we had once was a student of Buddhism.
Can you please speak up some more?
Sure. I was speaking to a guest that we had once who was a student of Buddhism, but I don't remember his name. He mentioned that one interesting distinction for Christianity is that in a lot of Indian faiths, there were people whose job it was to write down what was happening. And if you look at the followers of some of the Indian faiths, they were learned people. And when you compare that to Christianity, you had fishers and tax collectors and a lot of people who weren't necessarily literate, who were charged with keeping the movement going. And so that nature of writing down may not be the same.
Quite true. And of course, we don't want to make a caste issue out of it, but there's no doubt about it that the Brahminical roots of in Hinduism or Vedanta are quite different than the roots for any of the other religions except Buddhism. Yes. Vijay, I saw your hand first.
Swamiji, since you said that there's a whole lot common between Christianity and Vedanta, and we didn't have that much time to spend on it today, would it be possible to have a separate lecture on the material, Vedanta and Christianity?
I pointed out that we've done that in every Christmas lecture for so many years past. That's what the Christmas sermon has been about in the past years. I thought we'd do something different this time.
And it's Sunday lecture.
But I mean, I've done it a number of times. I could do it again if there are people who want it.
Another item, just as an interesting point that I heard last Sunday at a church service in Seattle, Washington, the preacher pointed out the commonality between Jesus and Lord Krishna, in that Jesus was born in the manger, and Lord Krishna being born in the prison cell.
Yeah, there are lots of superficial resemblances. Yes. That doesn't mean much. I don't think it means much historically. You had your question. Didn't you? Dave?
I was going to ask why the word is made of the Christian-Christ connection, because there's correlations running all the way through from the birth.
I don't think it means a thing. I mean, if you're talking about borrowing or historical or anything like that, I really don't think that means anything. What it means is that an avatar, that's the avatar story. The avatar is born in humble circumstances, and he has to struggle and to be recognized, and the various forces are put into play to come and acknowledge him, and other forces to disallow. It's the universal story. There's no need to assume borrowing. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to follow up and reinforce what you're saying. I mean, the stories about Jesus' birth were stories that were added later to the gospel.
I totally think. You know,
so
yes.
That's not. That was something that was tacked on. That was not the original.
Joseph Campbell tells you about this in The Hero. You read the book called Hero with a Thousand Faces. You'll see how many ways this can happen. Yes?
Following up on him, the scholars have established that Paul's letters, about 7 or 8 of those, in fact, they have even established one of them as a complete fake. Those are the earliest Christian documents, 50 AD, maybe. And then all the Gospels are much later. So
no, there's document G. There are old documents.
Q.
Huh? Document G and document Q, support the Gospels.
Well, they do, but adding stories about Jesus in the Gospels is...
Oh, yeah. All right. Okay, the stories. Yeah.
So
okay. Did you have a question?
Really,
what do you suppose Jesus meant when he said, "I am the way, the truth, the life"?
Well, that's another whole sermon. Yeah, I've talked on that here many times.
What is the position?
That I is logos. The logos. The Ishwara, Saguna Brahman. Not I, the historical person.
Swami, could we have an open forum on this in the New Year?
An open forum on what?
On the subject of Jesus in all faiths, because I think even us from different Christian faiths, there are so many differences and ideas. Okay.
Usually we leave Christmas behind at the New Year, but go on if you want to. Wait just a minute. I didn't realize those who are new here. See what a distinguished group of people we have in here. How knowledgeable they all are. I have to bow to them. Come.
Okay, I read Swamiji's book, Swami Vivekananda.
Yeah.
And he doesn't attach much importance to Jesus. In fact, he doubts.
In one time, in one moment.
He also doubts the existence of Krishna.
Yeah.
And he probably doesn't give any importance to that, but he gives most importance to Buddha, and throughout his books I found he honors Buddha as number one in the whole history of mankind.
Yes, because...
But he doesn't even recognize Jesus and Krishna.
Yes, but you don't read there what he thinks about Sri Ramakrishna. When he that's not written in the books. That comes down in the order by word of mouth. What he thinks, what he says another place, he says Sri Ramakrishna went beyond all of the prophets. He's greater than all of them. And don't quote Swami Vivekananda in part, because you cannot comprehend all the things he said in one, expression. You're right. He admired the humanistic approach of Buddha and the people who didn't claim divinity. That was a matter of great admiration for Swamiji, but he was a Hindu and he believed in the divinity of Sri Ramakrishna and Jesus, and the snow is beginning to fall. So I think we better put an end to this. Let me say that our Christmas Eve service starts at 8 and finishes hopefully by 9:15 or so. We try to let you go home and have your Christmas afterwards, but we would like to have you come and celebrate with us on Friday night at 8 o'clock if you can make it. And
bring cookies.
Oh yes, bring uncooked edibles and whatever you want, nuts and fruits and sweets for offering. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees. May the gods be peaceful. May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om, peace be unto us, and to all beings everywhere.